Ennead 3, Book 7, Part 2, by Plotinus. Translated by Kenneth Sylvan Guthrie. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Jeffrey Edwards. B. Time. The opinions of the philosophers about time must be studied. If those blessed ancient philosophers had not already uttered their views about time, we would only need to add to the idea of eternity which we have to say of the idea of time, and to set forth our opinion on the subject, trying to make it correspond with the already expressed notion of eternity. But we now must examine the most reasonable opinions that have been advanced about time, and observe how far our own opinion may conform thereto. Time, considered either as motion, as something movable, or something of motion. To begin with, we may divide the generally accepted opinions about time into three classes: time as movement, as something movable, or as some part of movement. It would be too contrary to the notion of time to try to define it as rest, as being at rest, or as some part of rest, for time is incompatible with identity, and consequently with rest, and with what is at rest. Those who consider time as movement claim that it is either any kind of movement, or the movement of the universe. Those who consider it as something movable are thinking of the sphere of the universe, while those who consider time as some part of movement consider it either as the interval of movement, or as its measure, or as some consequence of movement in general, or regular movement. Polemic against the Stoics. Time is not movement. 7. Brackets 8. Time cannot, as the Stoics claim, be movement. Neither can we gather together all movements so as to form but a single one. Nor can we consider the regular movement only, for these two kinds of motion are within time. If we were to suppose that there was a movement that did not operate within time, such a movement would still be far removed from being time, since, under this hypothesis, the movement itself is entirely different from that in which the movement occurs. Amidst the many reasons which, in past and present, have been advanced to refute this opinion, a single one suffices, namely, that movement can cease and stop, while time never suspends its flight. To the objection that the movement of the universe never stops, we may answer that this movement, if it consists in the circular movement of the stars, according to Hestius of Perinthus, or of the sun, according to Eratosthenes, operates within a definite time, at the end of which it returns to the same point of the heavens, but it does not accomplish this within the same space of time taken up in fulfilling the half of its course. One of these movements is only half of the other, and the second is double. Besides, both the one that runs through half of space and the one that runs through the whole of it are movements of the universe. Besides, it has been noticed that the movement of the exterior sphere is the swiftest. This distinction supports our view, for it implies that the movement of this sphere and the time used to operate it are different entities. The most rapid movement is the one that takes up the least time and runs through the greatest amount of space. The slowest movements are those that employ the longest time and run through only a part of that space. Polemic against the Pythagoreans. time is not what is movable. On the other hand, if time be not the movement of the sphere, evidently it is far less than that which is movable, as thought the Pythagoreans, or as Pythagoras thought, the sphere of heaven itself, as some have thought, because it moves. This fact alone is sufficient to refute the opinion that confuses time with that which is movable. Polemic against the Stoic Zeno. Time is no interval of movement. Is time, then, some part of movement? Zeno calls it the interval of movement, but the interval is not the same for all movements, even if the latter were of similar nature, for movements that operate within space may be swifter or slower. It is possible that the intervals of the most rapid and of the slowest movement might be measured by some third interval, which might far more reasonably be considered time. But which of these three intervals shall be called time? Rather, which of all the intervals, infinite in number as they are, shall time be? If time be considered the interval of the regular movement, it will not be the particular interval of every regular movement. Otherwise, as there are several regular movements, there would be several kinds of time. If time be defined as the interval of movement of the universe, that is, the interval contained within this movement, it will be nothing else than this movement itself. Persistent movement and its interval are not time, but are within it. Besides, this movement is a definite quantity. Either this quantity will be measured by the extension of the space traversed, and the interval will consist in that extension, but that extension is space and not time. Or we shall say that movement has a certain interval because it is continuous, and that instead of stopping immediately, it always becomes prolonged. But this continuity is nothing else than the magnitude that is the duration of the movement. Even though, after consideration of a movement, it be estimated as great, as might be said of a great heat, this does not yet furnish anything in which time might appear and manifest. We have here only a sequence of movements which succeed one another like waves, and only the observed interval between them. Now, the sequence of movements forms a number, such as 2 or 3, and the interval is an extension. Thus, the magnitude of the movement will be a number, say, such as 10, or an interval that manifests in the extension traversed by the movement. Now, the notion of time is not revealed herein, but we find only a quantity that is produced within time. Otherwise, time, instead of being everywhere, will exist only in the movement as an attribute in a substrate, which amounts to saying that time is movement. For the interval of the movement is not outside of movement, and is only a non-instantaneous movement. If, then, time be a non-instantaneous movement, just as we often say that some particular instantaneous fact occurs within time, we shall be forced to ask the difference between what is and what is not instantaneous. Do these things differ in relation to time? Then the persisting movement and its interval are not time, but within time. Polemic against Strato. Time is not motion and rest. Somebody might object that time is indeed the interval of movement, but that it is not the characteristic interval of movement itself, being only the interval in which movement exerts its extension, following along with it. All these terms lack definition. This extension is nothing else than the time within which the movement occurs. But that is precisely the question at issue from the very start. It is as if a person who had been asked to define time should answer, "Time is the interval of the movement produced within time." What, then, is this interval called time when considered outside of the interval characteristic of movement? If the interval characteristic of time be made to consist in movement, where shall the duration of rest be posited? Indeed, for one object to be in motion implies that another corresponding object is at rest. Now, the time of these objects is the same, though for one it be the time of movement, and for the other the time of rest, as thought Strato. What, then, is the nature of this interval? It cannot be an interval of space, since space is exterior to the movements that occur within it. Polemic against Aristotle. Time is not the number and measure of movement. 8(9). Let us now examine in what sense it may be said by Aristotle that time is the number and measure of movement, which definition seems more reasonable because of the continuity of movement. To begin with, following the method adopted with the definition of time as the interval of movement, we might ask whether time be the measure and number of any kind of movement. For how, indeed, could we give a numerical valuation of unequal or irregular movement? What system of numbering or measurement shall we use for this? If the same measure be applied to slow or to swift movement, in their case, measure and number will be the same as the number 10 applied equally to horses and oxen. And further, such measure might also be applied to dry and wet substances. If time be a measure of this kind, we clearly see that it is the measure of movements, but we do not discover what it may be in itself. If the number 10 can be conceived as a number, after making abstraction of the horses it served to measure, if, therefore, a measure possesses its own individuality, even while no longer measuring anything, the case must be similar with time, inasmuch as it is a measure. If, then, time be a number in itself, in what does it differ from the number 10, or from any other number composed of unities? As it is a continuous measure, and as it is a quantity, it might, for instance, turn out to be something like a foot rule. It would, then, be a magnitude, as, for instance, a line, which follows the movement. But how will this line be able to measure what it follows? Why would it measure one thing rather than another? It seems more reasonable to consider this measure not as the measure of every kind of movement, but only as the measure of the movement it follows. Then, that measure is continuous, so far as the movement it follows itself continued to exist. In this case, we should not consider measure as something exterior and separated from movement, but as united to the measured movement. What, then, will measure? Is it the movement that will be measured, and the extension that will measure it? Which of these two things will time be? Will it be the measuring movement or the measuring extension? Time will be either the movement measured by extension or the measuring extension, or some third thing which makes use of extension, as one makes use of a foot rule to measure the quantity of movement. But in all these cases, we must, as has already been noticed, suppose that movement is uniform. For unless the movement be uniform, one and universal, the theory that movement is a measure of any kind whatever will become almost impossible. If time be measured movement, that is, measured by quantity, besides granting that it at all needs to be measured, movement must not be measured by itself, but by something different. On the other hand, if movement have a measure different from itself, and if, consequently, we need a continuous measure to measure it, the result would be that extension itself would need measure, so that movement, being measured, may have a quantity which is determined by that of the thing according to which it is measured. Consequently, under this hypothesis, time would be the number of the extension which follows movement, and not extension itself which follows movement. Nor can time be a numbered number, as Aristotle claimed. What is this number? Is it composed of unities? How does it measure? That would still have to be explained. Now, let us suppose that we had discovered how it measures. We would still not have discovered the time that measures, but a time that was such or such an amount. Now, that is not the same thing as time. There is a difference between time and some particular quantity of time. Before asserting that time has such or such a quantity, we have to discover the nature of that which has that quantity. We may grant that time is the number which measures movement, while remaining exterior thereto, as 10 is in 10 horses, without being conceived with them, as Aristotle claimed that it was not a numbering, but a numbered number. But in this case, we still have to discover the nature of this number that, before numbering, is what it is, as would be 10 considered in itself. It may be said that it is that number which, by following number, measures according to the priority and posteriority of that movement. Nor do we yet perceive the nature of that number which measures by priority and posteriority. In any case, whatever measures by priority or posteriority or by a present moment or by anything else certainly does measure according to time. Thus, this number which measures movement according to priority or posteriority must touch time, and, to measure movement, be related thereto. Prior and posterior necessarily designate either different parts of space, as, for instance, the beginning of a stadium, or parts of time. What is called priority is time that ends with the present. What is called posteriority is the time that begins at the present. Time, therefore, is something different from the number that measures movement according to priority or posteriority. I do not say any kind of movement, but still regular movement. Besides, why should we have time by applying number either to what measures or to what is measured? For in this case, these two may be identical. If movement exists along with the priority and posteriority which relate thereto, why will we not have time without number? This would amount to saying that extension has such a quantity only in case of the existence of somebody who recognizes that it possesses that quantity. Since Aristotle says that time is infinite, and that it is such effectually, how can it contain number without our taking a portion of time to measure it? From that would result that time existed before it was measured. But why could time not exist before the existence of a soul to measure it? Aristotle might have answered that it was begotten by the soul. The mere fact that the soul measures time need not necessarily imply that the soul produced the time. Time, along with its suitable quantity, would exist even if nobody measured it. If, however, it be said that it is the soul that makes use of extension to measure time, we will answer that this is of no importance to determine the notion of time. Polemic against Epicurus. Time is not an accident or consequence of movement. 9. 10. When Epicurus says that time is a consequence of movement, he is not explaining the nature of time. This would demand a preliminary definition of the consequence of movement. Besides, this alleged consequence of movement, granting the possibility of such a consequence, must be prior, simultaneous, or posterior. For in whatever way we conceive of it, it is within time. Consequently, if the consequence of movement be time, the result would be that time is a consequence of movement in time, which is nonsense. Plotinus can go no further in refuting endless definitions of time. Now, as our purpose is to discover not what time is not, but what it really is, we notice that this question has been treated at great length by many thinkers before us. And if we were to undertake to consider all existing opinions on the subject, we would be obliged to write a veritable history of the subject. We have here, however, gone to the limit of our ability in treating it without specializing in it. As has been seen, it is easy enough to refute the opinion that time is the measure of the movement of the universe, and to raise against this opinion the objections that we have raised against the definition of time as the measure of movement in general, opposing thereto the irregularity of movement and the other points from which suitable arguments may be drawn. We are, therefore, free to devote ourselves to an explanation of what time really is. The nature of time will be revealed by its origin. 10(11). To accomplish this, we shall have to return to the nature, which, as we pointed out above, was essential to eternity, that immutable life, wholly realized all at once, infinite and perfect, subsisting in and referring to unity. Time was not yet, or at least it did not yet exist, for the intelligible entities. Only it was yet to be born of them, because, as was the world, time, by both its reason and nature, was posterior to the intelligible entities. Are we trying to understand how time issued from among intelligible entities while these were resting within themselves? Here it would be useless to call upon the Muses, for they did not yet exist. Still, this might perhaps not be useless, for in a certain sense, that time had already begun, then, so far as they existed within the sense world, they existed already. In any case, the birth of time will be plain enough if we consider it only as it is born and manifested. Thus much can be said about it. Time arose as measurement of the activity of the universal soul. Before priority and posteriority, time, which did not yet exist, brooded within existence itself. But an active nature, the universal soul, which desired to be mistress of herself, to possess herself, and ceaselessly to add to the present, entered into motion, as did time, along with the soul. We achieve a representation of the time that is the image of eternity by the length that we must go through with to reach what follows and is posterior towards one moment, and then towards another. Like time, space is the result of the procession of the universal soul. As the universal soul contained an activity that agitated her and impelled her to transport into another world what she still saw on high, she was willing to retain all things that were present at the same time. Time arose not by a single fiat, but as the result of a process. This occurred within the universal soul, but may well be first illustrated by the more familiar process within reason, which distributes unity, not indeed that which remains within itself, but that which is exterior to itself. Though this process seemed to be a strengthening one, reason, developing out of the seed in which it brooded unto manifoldness, it is really a weakening or destructive one, inasmuch as it weakened manifoldness by division and weakened reason by causing it to extend. The case was similar with the universal soul, when she produced the sense world. The latter was animated by a movement which was only an image of intelligible movement, while trying to strengthen this image movement to the extent of the intelligible movement, she herself, weakened, instead of remaining exclusively eternal, became temporal and involuntarily subjected what she had produced to the conditions of time, transferring entirely into time not only the universe, but also all its revolutions. Indeed, as the world moves within the universal soul, which is its location, it also moves within the time that this soul bears within herself. Manifesting her power in a varied and successive manner, by her mode of action, the universal soul begat succession. Indeed, she passes from one conception to another, and consequently to what did not exist before, since this conception was not effective, and since the present life of the soul does not resemble her former life. Her life is varied, and from the variety of her life results the variety of time. Time is the life of the soul, considered in the movement by which she passes from one actualization to another. Thus, the extension of the life of the soul produces time, and the perpetual progression of her life produces the perpetuity of time, and her former life constitutes the past. We may therefore properly define time as the life of the soul considered in the movement by which she passes from one actualization to another. What eternity is to intelligence, time is to the universal soul. We have already decided that eternity is life characterized by rest, identity, immutability, and infinity in intelligence. It is further admitted that this our world is the image of the superior world of intelligence. We have also come to the conclusion that time is the image of eternity. Consequently, corresponding to the life characteristic of intelligence, this world must contain another life which bears the same name, and which belongs to that power of the universal soul. Instead of the movement of intelligence, we will have the movement characteristic of a part of the soul, as the universal soul ceaselessly passes from one thought to another, corresponding to the permanence, identity, and immutability of intelligence. We will have the mobility of a principle which ceaselessly passes from one actualization to another, corresponding to the unity and the absence of all extension. We will have a mere image of unity, an image which exists only by virtue of continuity, corresponding to an infinity already entirely present. We will have a progression towards infinity, which perpetually tends towards what follows. Corresponding to what exists entirely at the same time, we will have what exists by parts, and what will never exist entire at the same time. The soul's existence will have to be ceaseless acquiring of existence, if it is to reveal an image of the complete, universal, and infinite existence of the soul. That is the reason its existence is able to represent the intelligible existence. Time is as interior to the soul as eternity is to existence. Time, therefore, is not something external to the soul, any more than eternity is exterior to existence. It is neither a consequence nor a result of it, any more than eternity is a consequence of existence. It appears within the soul, is in her and with her, as eternity is in and with existence. Time is the length of the life of the universal soul. 11(12). The result of the preceding considerations is that time must be conceived of as the length of the life characteristic of the universal soul, that her course is composed of changes that are equal, uniform, and insensible, so that that course implies a continuity of action. Now, let us for a moment suppose that the power of the soul should cease to act and to enjoy the life she at present possesses without interruption or limit, because this life is the activity characteristic of an eternal soul, an action by which the soul does not return upon herself and does not concentrate on herself, though enabling her to beget and produce. Now, supposing that the soul should cease to act, that she should apply her superior part to the intelligible world and to eternity, and that she should there remain calmly united, what then would remain unless eternity? For what room for succession would that allow if all things were immovable in unity? How could she contain priority, posteriority, or more or less duration of time? How could the soul apply herself to some object other than that which occupies her? Further, one could not then even say that she applied herself to the subject that occupied her. She would have to be separated therefrom in order to apply herself thereto. Neither would the universal sphere exist, since it does not exist before time, because it exists and moves within time. Besides, even if this sphere were at rest during the activity of the soul, we could measure the duration of her rest, because this rest is posterior to the rest of eternity. Since time is annihilated so soon as the soul ceases to act and concentrates in unity, time must be produced by the beginning of the soul's motion towards sense objects, by the soul's life. Consequently, Plato says that time is born with the universe because the soul produced time with the universe. For it is this very action of the soul which has produced this universe. This action constitutes time, and the universe is within time. Plato does indeed call the movements of the stars time, but evidently only figuratively, as Plato subsequently says that the stars were created to indicate the divisions of time and to permit us to measure it easily. Time is not begotten by movement, but only indicated thereby. Indeed, as it was not possible to determine the time itself of the soul, and to measure within themselves the parts of an invisible and unrecognizable duration, especially for men who did not know how to count, the world soul created day and night so that their succession might be the basis of counting as far as two, by the aid of this variety. Plato indicates that as the source of the notion of number. Later, observing the space of time which elapses from one dawn to another, we were able to discover an interval of time determined by an uniform movement, so far as we direct our gaze thereupon, and as we use it as a measure by which to measure time. The expression, to measure time, is premeditated, because time, considered in itself, is not a measure. How indeed could time measure, and what would time, while measuring, say, would time say of anything, here is an extension as large as myself? What indeed could be the nature of the entity that would speak of myself? Would it be that according to which quantity is measured? In this case, time would have to be something by itself, to measure without itself being a measure. The movement of the universe is measured according to time, but it is not the nature of time to be the measure of movement. It is such only accidentally. It indicates the quantity of movement because it is prior to it and differs from it. On the other hand, in the case of a movement produced within a determinate time, and if a number be added thereto frequently enough, we succeed in reaching the knowledge of how much time has elapsed. It is therefore correct to say that the movement of the revolution operated by the universal sphere measures time so far as possible by its quantity, indicating the corresponding quantity of time, since it can neither be grasped nor conceived otherwise. Thus, what is measured, that is, what is indicated by the revolution of the universal sphere, is time. It is not begotten, but only indicated by movement. Movement is said to be measured by space because of its indetermination. The measure of movement, therefore, seems to be what is measured by a definite movement, but which is other than this movement. There is a difference, indeed, between that which is measured and that which measures, but that which is measured only by accident. That would amount to saying that what is measured by a foot rule is an extension, without defining what extension in itself is. In the same way, because of the inability to define movement more clearly because of its indeterminate nature, we say that movement is that which is measured by space. For by observation of the space traversed by movement, we can judge of the quantity of the movement. Time is measured by movement, and in that sense it is the measure of movement. 12:13. The revolution of the universal sphere leads us, therefore, to the recognition of time, within which it occurs. Not only is time that in which all things become, that is, grow, but time has to be what it is even before all things, being that within which everything moves or rests with order and uniformity. This is discovered and manifested to our intelligence, but not produced by regular movement and rest, especially by movement. Better than rest, indeed, does movement lead us to a conception of time, and it is either to appreciate the duration of movement than that of rest. That is what led philosophers to define time as the measure of movement, instead of saying what probably lay within their intention, that time is measured by movement. Above all, we must not consider that definition as adequate, adding to it that which the measured entity is in itself, not limiting ourselves to express what applies to it only incidentally. Neither did we ever discern that such was their meaning, and we were unable to understand their teachings, as they evidently posited the measure in the measured entity. No doubt, that which hindered us from understanding them was that they were addressing their teachings to learned thinkers or well-prepared listeners, and therefore, in their writings, they failed to explain the nature of time considered in itself, whether it be measure or something measured. Plato does make some statements that allow of being justified. Plato himself, indeed, does say not that the nature of time is to be a measure or something measured, but that to make it known there is, in the circular movement of the universe, a very short element, the interval of a day, whose object is to demonstrate the smallest portion of time, through which we are enabled to discover the nature and quantity of time, in order to indicate to us its nature, being, Plato says that it was born with the heavens, and that it is the mobile image of eternity. Time is mobile because it has no more permanence than the life of the universal soul, because it passes on and flows away therewith. It is born with the heavens because it is one and the same life that simultaneously produces the heavens and time. If, granting its possibility, the life of the soul were reduced to the unity of the intelligence, there would be an immediate cessation of time, which exists only in this life, and the heavens, which exist only through this life. Time, as the prior and posterior of the movement of this life, would be absurd. The theory that time is the priority and posteriority of this earthly movement and of this inferior life is ridiculous, in that it would imply, on one hand, that the priority and posteriority of this sense life are something, and, on the other, refusing to recognize as something real a truer movement which includes both priority and posteriority. It would indeed amount to attributing to an inanimate movement the privilege of containing within itself priority with posteriority, that is, time, while refusing it to the movement of the soul, whose movement of the universal sphere is no more than an image. Still, it is from the movement of the soul that originally emanated priority and posteriority, because this movement is efficient by itself. By producing all its actualizations, it begets succession, and at the same time that it begets succession, it produces the passing from one actualization to another. The primary movement of intelligence, the informing power of time. Some objector might ask why we reduce the movement of the universe to the movement of the containing soul, and admit that she is within time, while we exclude from time the universal soul's movement, which subsists within her and perpetually passes from one actualization to another. The reason is that above the activity of the soul, there exists nothing but eternity, which shares neither her movement nor her extension. Thus, the primary movement of intelligence finds its goal in time, begets it, and by its activity informs its duration. Why time is present everywhere. Polemic against Antiphanes and Critolaus. How then is time present everywhere? The life of the soul is present in all parts of the world, as the life of our soul is present in all parts of our body. It may indeed be objected that time constitutes neither a hypostatic substance nor a real existence, being in respect to existence a deception, just as we usually say that the expressions "he was" and "he will be" are a deception in respect to the divinity, for then he will be and was just as is that in which, according to his assertion, he is going to be. To answer these objections, we shall have to follow a different method. Here it suffices to recall what was said above, namely, that by seeing how far a man in motion has advanced, we can ascertain the quantity of the movement, and that when we discern movement by walking, we simultaneously concede that before the walking, movement in that man was indicated by a definite quantity, since it caused his body to progress by some particular quantity. As the body was moved during a definite quantity of time, its quantity can be expressed by some particular quantity of movement, for this is the movement that causes it. and to its suitable quantity of time. Then this movement will be applied to the movement of the soul, which by her uniform action produces the interval of time. The movement of the soul is attributed to the primary movement. To what shall the movement of the universal soul be attributed? To whatever we may choose to attribute it. This will always be some indivisible principle, such as primary motion, which within its duration contains all the others, and is contained by none other, for it cannot be contained by anything. It is, therefore, genuinely primary. The same obtains with the universal soul. Approval of Aristotle. Time is also within us. Is time also within us? It is uniformly present in the universal soul, and in the individual souls that are all united together. Time, therefore, is not parcelled out among the souls any more than eternity is parcelled out among the entities in the intelligible world, which in this respect are all mutually uniform. End of Ennead 3, Book 7.